This is Points North, a podcast about the land, water, and inhabitants of the Great Lakes. I'm Dan Wanshura. One morning, Big Abe LeBlanc got up and got ready to go fishing on Lake Superior. This was something he often did in secret, under the cover of darkness, hiding from the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. But on this particular day, he picked up the phone and called the DNR. His son, Sonny LeBlanc, was there with him.
I just remember him saying that, you know, this is where I'll be, and if you want me, come get me.
It was 1971, and Big Abe, who's Ojibwe, was preemptively turning himself in for two crimes, at least according to Michigan law. The first crime, commercial fishing without a license. The second, fishing with illegal equipment. After Big Abe hung up, he and Sonny drove a half hour to Pendles Bay in Lake Superior. The car ride was quiet. It was late September. The trees were just starting to show bits of fall color. And when they got there, they pushed their small fishing boat across the sandy beach and went out on the water. In front of them was this wide open expanse of Lake Superior. Behind them was Big Abe's daughter-in-law, Joanne LeBlanc, waiting on the beach and watching with her newborn baby on her hip.
It was a kind of a cool morning. The water was nice and calm. And when the water is calm like that, you can hear way far away, you know, because water carries your voices.
Abe and Sonny were murmuring as they set their fishing nets a few hundred feet offshore. Then conservation officers started to show up on the beach next to Joanne.
I was kind of feeling like apprehensive, maybe scared or whatever, because I didn't know what it might turn into.
What it turned into changed fishing in the Great Lakes forever. Reporter Ellie Katz takes it from here.
Big Abe's name was actually Albert B. LeBlanc, but he got his nickname for a reason.
Oh man, you definitely noticed him. He was like, what, 6'3"?
No, he was 6'6".
Oh, 6'6", about 350.
And Big Abe had a big family. These are two of his 13 kids, Ruby LeBlanc Hatfield and Evelyn LeBlanc McPherson. Here's Ruby again.
And so being a big man, he had a big voice. Every morning, my Uncle Art, his brother, would show up and they'd have coffee and talk. You could hear them. I mean, we were, you know, we'd be sleeping, and I'm talking early, like 5, 6 in the morning. And that was basically our alarm clock, because you could hear them talking regardless where you were in the house.
Abe's granddaughter, Whitney Gravel, never met him, but she grew up hearing about his voice.
You know, my mom said it used to be like thunder and lightning fighting with one another, and it would be like boom, 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 back and forth, and then they'd stop and then drink their coffee and go about their day.
Those early morning conversations later became famous in the family, not just because of Abe and his brother's booming voices, but because of what they talked about.
And they would debate over treaty rights, they would debate over history, they would like argue with one another, but it was always done out of like friendliness. And I remember being told that Grandpa would always pull out of his copy of the treaty and be like, look, brother, you know, like, this is what it says. This is what we're entitled to.
Big Abe and his brother were studying their fishing and hunting rights as Ojibwe Native Americans, based on a treaty from 1836. And they were starting to fight for those rights, too. Around this time, in the early 70s, Big Abe helped write telegrams to people like Senator Ted Kennedy and President Richard Nixon, asking the federal government for help. Here are excerpts of what he wrote. Dear Mr. President, the Bay Mills Indian community and other groups of Indians depend on fishing as a source of income and their very livelihood. By the power of the office which you hold, we ask you to intervene on behalf of our people. Big Abe was a commercial fisherman, catching the same fish Ojibwe people had caught in Lake Superior for generations. By the mid-1900s, commercial fishing was one of the main ways for Native people to make a living in rural Michigan. Otherwise, tribal members often had to move hundreds of miles away to work in auto plants or factories. Big Abe needed the U.S. to intervene because the state of Michigan was cracking down on commercial fishermen. The state created new requirements that most bootstrapped tribal commercial fishermen couldn't meet. These changes suddenly made it nearly impossible for them to fish legally, according to state law. The thing is, Big Abe and other Anishinaabe fishermen argued that was wrong, that they had the right to fish however they wanted, and the state couldn't intervene. Their ancestors had signed a treaty with the U.S. government that protected those rights. So they couldn't meet the state's requirements, but they still wanted and needed to fish.
Dad used to take us fishing at night. We fished at night.
This is Big Abe's son, Jacques LeBlanc.
That's the way fishing was done for a native back then, because we didn't have a license to fish. The DNR would be looking for us. And we hid under logs, and we hid behind rocks. And sometimes they'd catch us, sometimes they'd walk right by us.
At the same time they were keeping an eye out for DNR officers, non-native anglers were taking things a step further. They believed that native fishermen were hoarding fish for themselves.
Dealing with racism, we dealt with that every way, shape, or form. From our boats getting sunk, you know, to tires being slashed, to sugar in the gas tanks, to, you know, shots fired in the air around us.
Abe's daughter-in-law, Joanne LeBlanc, was around 21 when all this was happening. Her husband, Sonny, and other fishermen would go fish at night, and she'd go with them. She remembers one night in particular.
I can remember sleeping underneath the truck, hidden with him. And then, you know, them going out there and getting that net.
All of a sudden, they heard unfamiliar voices from far off.
I remember somebody says, "There they are!" Like that. Everybody scattered, you know, and I had a pack of fish on my back and I threw it around and it popped right in front of me. But I ran. I did run. That was scary. I didn't know what was going to happen.
One individual had his boat cut free from the dock as a form of harassment.
Abe's granddaughter, Whitney again.
And he swam out to try and grab it, because when you don't have a lot of economic means and that's your way of life and that's how you provide for your family, of course you're going to try and retrieve it. And he ended up drowning in the water trying to get his boat back. So like, people were dying as this was happening.
By 1971, the entire community was tired of this. An indigenous rights movement was sweeping across the country. They believed they still had a right to fish. They just needed a way to prove it.
Someone needed to take a stand. Someone needed to defend the treaty right. And then someone needed to affirm it as a way and a means to say, like, hey, not only is this our right, but it's a protected right, and you can't do this to us anymore.
Tribal leaders at Bay Mills got together and laid out a strategy. One fisherman would be the guinea pig. He'd turn himself in, get arrested, and take his test case as far as possible in order to get the state courts to recognize treaty rights. Big Abe volunteered. Big Abe would later tell a reporter about that day in 1971. Quote, "That September 28th, I got into my boat, went out, and set some gill nets. I was in Pendles Bay, part of Whitefish Bay, offshore from the reservation. And I had a copy of the Treaty of 1836 in my pocket. I just sat there and waited." Unquote. When the DNR officers started arriving, Big Abe came towards shore. His daughter-in-law, Joanne, could hear his booming voice as he got closer.
Abe was not a man to mix his words or mess with his words, and those son of a bitches, you know, I could hear that coming in.
When he got on the beach, the officers told him he was under arrest. "The hell I am," Big Abe said. "You can't arrest me." Years later, the Grand Rapids Press reported that he pulled out his copy of the treaty and said, "This treaty gives me the right to fish." "We'll see about that," an officer said. He didn't cuff Big Abe and cart him away, but he did confiscate his net and write him a ticket. That ticket ordered him to appear in local district court for trial in a few days. What happened next after the break. Points North is brought to you in part by Cherry Republic, celebrating Northern Michigan's tart cherries with products like jams, barbecue sauces, chocolate-covered cherries, and more. Online at cherryrepublic.com. And Aspire North Realtors, bringing real estate professionals together, supporting their involvement in the community, and advocating for the industry in a sustainable way. Online at aspirenorthrealtors.com. How far back would you say you have paper copies of everything you've worked on?
Oh, since the 70s.
Oh my gosh, Candy. That's a lot of paper.
I know.
Candy Tierney has been a tribal attorney for around 50 years, and she's got cabinets full of court documents to prove it. When Candy got to Bay Mills in the 70s, she started working on Big Abe's case. 6'6", 350-pound Big Abe.
He was driving Cadillacs, and the frame was bent. No, on the driver's side, so you could definitely see the tilt.
In district court, Big Abe made the same argument he'd been making for years, that his tribe had signed a treaty with the U.S. government in 1836 protecting his right to fish, and the state couldn't intervene. The state disagreed. They argued that the Ojibwe and Odawa tribes who signed that treaty gave up those rights in a later treaty. Big Abe went to trial a week after he got his ticket in 1971.
And the court said, everything's settled. You know, there isn't any treaty right anymore.
But Big Abe and his lawyers were expecting that. So he appealed that decision. And then he appealed the next decision. And in the years between, he kept fishing. The case went back and forth until eventually, in March 1976, 5 years after his ticket, his case made it all the way to the Michigan Supreme Court. Candy got to the courthouse early to check things out, and the setup was not going to cut it.
Because they had maybe like three pews on each side, looked vaguely church-like, and, you know, I knew how many people were coming. I'm saying, you know, you're going to need to bring in chairs.
People started to pour in.
Most of the entire Bay Mills Indian community, for one.
Plus people from indigenous communities across the state. Keweenaw Bay, Saginaw Chippewa, Grand Traverse, Sault Ste. Marie.
There was anticipation and pride on the Indian side because finally, you know, we're in a court where, you know, treaty rights are respected and, you know, not considered to be some kind of flaky argument. And everybody saw this as their fight.
Then you had the state side. Tons of people from the DNR and from sport fishermen's groups.
It ended up being sort of like going to a wedding. Friends and family of the bride are on one side and the groom on the other.
Right behind Candy, in the front row of the audience, sat Big Abe.
Abe is a big man, and so he was more comfortable in great big t-shirts. And to find a shirt of any kind that would be possible to button or something, it wasn't necessarily that easy. But he did dress up for that.
Each side argued its case. Joanne, Big Abe's daughter-in-law, was there, watching Candy make her oral arguments.
She was calm, cool, and collected. Like, everybody listening, everything seemed to hinge on her next explanation or her next word, you know, or how she was going to explain, you know. But it was quiet.
The court transcripts from that day have been destroyed.
I don't remember exactly what I said. Those kinds of things sort of get kind of vague. But on this, we were talking about the treaty, the treaty, the treaty, the treaty.
I know, I kind of felt like standing up and clapping after she was done.
After just a few hours in the courtroom, the arguments ended and everybody left. They'd have to wait months before getting an answer.
We had no idea what the decision was going to be. They were pretty sure that their way of life was at risk because, you know, generations back beyond count, people relied upon the resources and the lands and the waters. So in a very real sense, they were fighting to continue to live in the type of communities that they always had and to share the values that were always important. You know, this was their not only economic survival, but their cultural survival that was at stake. I don't think I can exaggerate how important this was to people.
6 months later, Candy's phone rang.
The Supreme Court clerk called to say that the court had issued its decision. You know, she just said that, you know, they upheld the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Once she said that, you knew it was in your favor?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And what went through your head?
Hot damn.
Big Abe and hundreds of other Ojibwe and Odawa fishermen had the right to fish throughout huge portions of Lake Michigan, Superior, and Huron. And in the meantime, another big case was working its way through the legal system. Remember those telegrams Big Abe sent to Washington, D.C.? The federal government finally stepped up. They sued the state of Michigan on behalf of Bay Mills, saying they had the right to fish commercially. And in 1979, a federal judge in Grand Rapids sided with the tribes. It complemented the Michigan Supreme Court ruling that treaty rights were officially the law of the land, protecting not only economic survival, but cultural survival. It was a sweeping victory for Native American fishing rights in the Great Lakes. Big Abe's son, Jox, was a teenager by this point.
And I remember exactly where I was when it came over the radio.
What were you feeling? What did that mean to you?
Well, it was a long battle. We started fishing in the day more. We weren't running around at night. We got more and more advanced with the boats and the nets and the trucks and the trailers, because back when this all started, you know, we hit our boats in the trees. And we drove there in cars, we drove there in vans, we drove there in pickups, you know, and we took our boat out of trees and went out in the lake at night. You know, now we go out at a boat ramp, and that's the way it changed.
Similar legal action swept across the region in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And the federal case laid the groundwork for how fisheries are managed and regulated in Michigan today, a negotiation between tribal nations, the U.S. government, and the state of Michigan. For Big Abe's kids and community, that's part of his legacy.
That he did it for all natives. He didn't do it for himself. He wasn't looking to be the center of attention. This is, for me, real emotional stuff. Because it's my livelihood. And it's going to be till day I die.
Albert B. LeBlanc, Big Abe, died a few years after the federal victory in January 1983. He was only 59 years old. He was buried in Mission Hill Cemetery in Bay Mills, overlooking Lake Superior.
When he passed, you know, the tributes were very heartfelt, very eloquent. It was mourning someone who put everything on the line without any guarantee that it was going to be successful.
Years later, when a governing body was created to bring all the 1836 tribes together to manage natural resources, the headquarters was named after Big Abe.
Maybe somebody else would have stood up, but we never would know for sure. So we have our hero, if you will.
Big Abe's court victory still lives on today, but there are new things hurting the tribal fishery, and not everybody agrees on what they are. Some people point to new invasive species like quagga mussels causing another collapse of Great Lakes fisheries. Others say there aren't enough young tribal members who want to fish as a career, or that the tribes argue too much amongst themselves about how to allocate fish and fishing grounds, or that tribes don't have enough representation. And tribal fishermen still face harassment, especially when they fish in new areas. In 2023, something happened that at least closed Big Abe's chapter of the story.
So this was the net that was that my grandpa used when he was out fishing. This is actually old lead.
Big Abe's granddaughter, Whitney Gravel, is now the president of the Bay Mills Indian community. She opens a box in her office. It's the net the DNR confiscated that day in 1971.
It's tangled right now, but when we had received it from the state of Michigan, it had essentially been in an evidence locker for over 50 years.
Whitney says it was a little smelly when they first got it back. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer presented it to the family in a big wooden box. Big Abe's kids were there, including Jox, who's still a commercial fisherman.
Once I heard they were going to give it to us, I just wanted it. So once the governor presented it to us, I just told my brother, grab it, let's go. But after I got it back home here and I showed other people, then I had emotions. And people wanted to touch it because that's a net that started it all.
What were you feeling here?
Just pride.
Joanne got a chance to look at it too.
My first thing too is I wanted to feel it, and I did, just a little bit, but I felt it. And
what did it feel like?
Well, wow, I'm a part of history now, you know, touching this net that made the state acknowledge.
Acknowledge that Anishinaabe people always had the right to fish these waters commercially, and they always will.
That episode was written and produced by Ellie Katz. It was edited by Morgan Springer. Additional editing by Ed Ronco, Izzy Ross, Peter Payette, and me, Dan Wanshura. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Corinne Cameron, Charles and Nancy Cleland, Jason and Margaret Smith, Jeannie Franklin, Mark Ebener, and Kristen Sylvian. If you enjoyed this episode of Points North, be sure to share us with a friend this week. They can find us wherever they listen to podcasts. We're also on Instagram at Points North Podcast, and our website is pointsnorthpodcast.org. Points North is a production of Interlochen Public Radio.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.